Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Frame Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lamer, and today I'm joined by Saragon. Sarah, how are you?
Well, thank you. Thanks, Nick.
And Mr. John Andrews. John, how are you?
Very well, thanks, Nick. Thanks for inviting me back on the show.
Yep, always great to have you. I don't know. We have put it out in the public on both the Daily Friend and on the Institute of Race Relations website. But I believe I'm correct in saying that we haven't talked about it on the show, and that is that John Andrews is, in fact, being appointed as the new CEO of the Institute of Race Relations beginning next year, because, of course, France is stepping down from that position to be involved in other great and glorious things. And so I'm very happy to have John as my new boss, and so I will make sure to suck up appropriately from now on.
It is always well received, Nicholas. But
thank you very much.
So really looking forward to stepping into this role. And maybe later in the year, we can have a show about this, maybe get France and me on. We can just talk about the Institute and what the plans are for the future. That could be quite interesting.
Yeah, exactly. I think that'll be a lot of fun. All right. So on this cold, windy day, at least in Joburg, let us talk about the big story. And that is the high drama and the tension and the pushing of the nation to the brink that went on last night. And I'm, of course, referring to the arrest of Jacob Zuma, which is something I think that many people really didn't see, couldn't imagine. I mean, yesterday on the show, Terence Corrigan said that he just couldn't imagine Zuma in orange overalls and handcuffs. And to be fair, no one has seen a picture of such a thing yet, so we don't know whether it actually happened. But there was a lot of tension last night. The country had come to a point of crisis. It really looked like the government might not move to arrest Zuma. There was lots of something going on in the background that was very unclear. There were lots of rumors flying around about the Constitutional Court doing this and the police doing this and Becky Cele coming to visit and not coming to visit. There were a bunch of journalists standing outside in Kandla who were talking to one of Zuma's sons, who was very passionately suggesting that no one would be allowed to enter the thing without his permission and that they were going to die to protect Zuma. There were rumors that a big police convoy with lots of armored trucks were going towards Nkandla, and it was all getting very tense. And as midnight approached, which was, of course, the deadline for the police to act on the Constitutional Court order, there were some sort of strange events when, for example, at one point, an ambulance shows up in Kandla and at first is not let in and then apparently is let in. And some reports suggest that one of Zuma's wives basically went into shock when she heard that he was going to hand himself over and requested medical attention. But hand himself over, Zuma did, which is, I think, the one thing I certainly did not expect would happen. I really thought he would dig his heels in. And it leaves many questions. Questions about, is this part of some ploy? Is he really not as tough as everyone thought? And he blinked and decided that it was just easier to go. Was he convinced to avoid bloodshed to do this? It's very difficult, I think, to work out what exactly is going on. So, John, let me start with you with some of those questions. What exactly happened last night when Zuma handed himself over? I think it was something like 11:30, somewhere around there, that he basically he left in Kandla for the police station.
Yeah, I think we've really seen some remarkable events develop over the past weeks and months, maybe things that we didn't expect to see in South Africa, because our experience with former President Zuma has been that he's a very wily tactician who's managed to play every single card that he had, whether it was a strong hand or a weak hand, it didn't matter. He played all of the cards. And it seemed that there was an infinite supply of them and that he was going to be able to drag out the day of reckoning further and further until one day maybe he would die before he would ever need to face the law. And I think many of us had settled into an acceptance that that was the way it was going to play out and that there was no way around that. And so I think many of us are quite taken aback this morning to see the newspaper headline, Zuma jailed. That was, I think, a headline we never expected to see. And the events that led to this conclusion were, I wonder to which extent they were by design and also by desire of the ruling party. I get the sense that there was some element of an unintended consequence and an unintended outcome that emerged here. And what happened ultimately is that the Constitutional Court boxed Zuma into a very tight corner from which it was hard to design an escape. And in the end, it turned out to be impossible to design an escape from this. I think he was very well advised and counseled. So, you know, every single trick in the book was tried. Some tricks that we hadn't heard of or wouldn't have thought of were also tried. But ultimately, they all didn't work. And what I expect happened last night was that pressure was applied to Zuma and he was told, you know, dude, this is the end of the road. We've tried everything, you know, every legal trick in the book. We've assembled the crowds. We did whatever we could. This is it. There's no way forward. And the only two options now are to make things worse, to resist, to risk the bloodshed as you resist arrest, or to hand yourself over, and you have to do it now. And I was following the events last night as well on social media and saw the statement come out from the Jacob Zuma Foundation, I think at a quarter to midnight, 15 minutes left to go before, you know, the man needed to be arrested, saying that he had decided to hand himself over. So absolutely remarkable events that transpired yesterday.
Yeah, I yesterday on the show we talked about how this really was a point of crisis, and that if he wasn't arrested, it suggests that we really do have a two-tiered justice system. Now, I think that it's not like all of that has melted away and we're now in the sunny uplands of good function and all that sort of thing, but it is a positive sign. Although I must say, honestly, I would have preferred that there had been a peaceful arrest of him by the police. The fact that it wasn't clear whether the police were actually going to move if he hadn't handed himself over, it's a little bit worrying to me. Anyway, Sara, what are your thoughts on this whole thing? Do you agree with John? Is this all part of Zuma's next phase of his plan, or was this really the end of the road for him?
I think what this was, you see, he's been able to play the law since 2005. And this came in, this was like a side issue. It suddenly arose. It hadn't been planned for. It wasn't in the in the panoply of tricks that he normally applies to. It had to do with the Zuma the Zondo Commission. It wasn't about the sequence of events that has followed him one way or another for the last 16 odd years. So in that sense, it was completely from left side. And it involved the apex court. So his Stalingrad strategy has always been to play the different levels of court until nothing more can, and then something comes around because it's all fits within. This was unusual, and so he couldn't, and I don't think his lawyers either could really plan for it. They largely had to respond to it and see how the response went, and the response didn't go in his favor. So. Essentially, I think the part of the reason for our amazement that he handed himself over, although I don't think it's amazing, but it kind of the position of not having many alternatives. So I don't think he was going to take it quite to the brink. He didn't. I don't think he wanted to be responsible for what would happen from that. It's just that, you know, seeing him go, and as you say, the headlines of Zuma jailed is astonishing, whatever the circumstances. And I'm sure it would have suited certain factions of the ANC very well. And I think the faction that is more supportive of him, or rather hope that on Monday the Concord decision will be to rescind their decision to hold him in contempt and to jail him. So I think like anything that involves Zuma, it is colorful, it is complicated, it is controversial. I have only one question, and that is his son Edward said that he would die before his father went to jail. So I am waiting to see how Edward plans to carry that one out.
I suspect that he won't. So what's interesting about this actually is how in so many stories, when sort of a great figure falls like this, it often starts from a direction that no one really expects. So, of course, I believe I'm correct in saying that Zuma originally appoints the Sonderkommission, or sets up the Sonderkommission towards the end of his presidency. And then he gets called to testify before it after the political fortunes have changed. And in a sort of move of arrogant brinksmanship, he decides that he's going to resist it. And so this is the sequence of events that leads him to being found in contempt of court, and then eventually, you know, now being jailed for 15 months is the sentence he's been given. But what's so strange is that, you know, he was able to avoid for years and years and years these allegations and of charges of corruption and racketeering and all these things. And it was this that got him behind bars. Very strange. John, do you have anything to make of that?
Yeah, it reminds one of Al Capone, the gangster in the United States in the 1920s and 30s, I think, who the police couldn't pin anything on, you know, even though he was responsible for an enormous number of crimes, who ultimately got jailed for tax fraud or, you know, tax evasion. And this smacks a little bit of that, you know, the far more serious crimes, just can't pin them on the guy, can't get him to be held accountable for that, but you get him on a lesser charge. But what I also think is that the reason Zuma handed himself over ultimately was because he likes doing things on his own terms. And I think this was a way of, you know, in a very minor way, asserting his agency and saying, you know, I'm not going to be carried out of here. I'm not going to be manacled, handcuffed, and escorted out. I'm going on my own terms. I'm going in my own car. I'll present myself. So I think that was still an assertion of independence, even at that very late hour. What I also wonder about, though, so one thing is that I don't think this is the end of the road overall. So this is sort of one further step along the chain, one that didn't go Zuma's way. But there are still many, many other steps along that road. And I think, you know, that 50-month jail sentence, I don't think will be served, at least not the entire sentence. I'm sure there will be either parole or medical parole or ameliorating circumstances that will reduce that. And of course, there are the other criminal trials still underway. So he's not out of the woods yet. But this is, I think, was interesting because it was a sort of a big misstep in the sense that this was not the outcome he had anticipated from appointing the Sonderkommission and from standing up to it. Once again, asserting himself, asserting his agency, that didn't work out in this case.
Exactly. So the next question I have for you, for both of you, actually, is, and let me start with you again, John. What does this mean for Ramaphosa? He's been very quiet and sort of absent during this great constitutional crisis. And he is Ramaphosa going to return? In fact, there's a reading on this that you could say that this is, in fact, in some ways a negative development because nothing will change in terms of policy and governance and the influence of corruption. And yet there's going to be this huge groundswell of enthusiasm and support for Ramaphosa's government saying, look, we finally jailed the super corrupt president of previous years. What's your take on what comes next for the president?
I think it's really hard to read. I do detect, in as much as one can detect such things, signs of tension within the ruling party, in the sense, for example, that both Minister Sisulu and Jesse Duarte, I think, came out quite strongly in support of former President Zuma, which might indicate mixed allegiances with President Ramaphosa. But President Ramaphosa has also been very careful, I think, in the past not to be critical of President Zuma. And so he's certainly trying to, you know, cover the cracks and smooth everything out and pretend that everything is okay. But I could imagine that there are rumblings within the party and that there's great dissatisfaction and unhappiness about the fact that Mr. Zuma has now finally gone to jail. How that will play out in the public sphere and in the minds of the electorate, I don't see Mr. Ramaphosa getting that much of a boost from it. I think the likelihood is greater that he will be tainted. Zuma going to jail taints the ANC, it taints the Ramaphosa administration as well. So I don't think there are that many positives for the ANC coming out of this.
Sara, do you agree? Do you think Ramaphosa is really not going to see a regeneration?
I don't think so, because I think people will have followed it enough to understand that it was a matter of process, and that perhaps if Ramaphosa did anything, it was doing nothing. The only good thing was he didn't try in any way to stop the process from happening. But I don't think that gives him much in the way of any particular kudos. I think there's just that sense that things will keep roiling in the ANC, and you know, tomorrow's another day, and there'll be another crisis on one side or the other or both. People may want it to be more for in that respect than it is. The symbolism of it is different.
I must say that this was very classic Ramaphosa. Massive problem comes up, lots of difficult questions, not clear what he should be doing from his perspective. I mean, we know what he should be doing, but from his perspective, he's probably not as clear. And he just disappears. He vanishes into the woodwork. And this is not the first time that's happened. My father was telling me yesterday about incidents that were very similar with very exciting strikes that happened, I think, in the 90s when Ramaphosa worked for the National Union of Mine Workers. And he also performed similar disappearing acts. So I think that will hurt his ability to claim kudos from this, is that he just has vanished as though he was never in existence. Anyway, so yes, this is, I think, going to have some fallout for the next while, and we're really going to see how important Jacob Zuma was to the ANC. And of course, what his next move is, because I think I agree with you both that he's definitely got some, he's definitely going to try some other things because he's not out of the woods. All right. Let us move on to our next story for today. Let me just find my notes here. Yes. So opponents of us often talk about, so we often have raised the issue on this show and in the work of the IRR and in our writings on the dailyframe.co.za that the ANC is very much guided by the principles of the National Democratic Revolution, and that they are far more socialist than many of their than many people, especially overseas and also in the sort of elite media, seem to think. And we're often accused of scaremongering. Oh, this is all old documents from the ANC. The ANC doesn't really commit itself seriously to these things. It's all lip service. Well, for lip service, there's quite a lot of it going on, because Ramaphosa recently has challenged the South African Communist Party to advance the agenda of socialism. He was talking to them recently at the 100th year of the South African Communist Party's existence in a virtual rally. And he says that in its role played by ANC allies like the SACP that saw the country emerge from the oppression of apartheid, and that he said, the SACP has throughout its history remained a dependable ally, not only of our liberation movement, but of the oppressed and exploited masses in South Africa. It's been a forefront of struggle against racism and capitalist exploitation, understanding tough relationships between race and class in South Africa. And he basically went on to say that, you know, we should all go full guns blazing on socialism. And if you looked at Ramaphosa's policies, you would not be terribly surprised to see that this lines up very neatly with expropriation without compensation and many other policy drives. John, your thoughts on this?
Well, I thought there was something quite deliciously incongruous and seeing a multi-billionaire in a tailored suit speaking to the South African Communist Party and encouraging them to advance the cause of socialism. Because, you know, under a socialist system, probably he would not be where he is in terms of his wealth. As a member of the elite, he probably would be quite wealthy, but not as wealthy as he's now, and also not with access to as many goods and services as he has now. So that's the one thing. And the other thing is, of course, where did his wealth come from? You know, it doesn't have its origins in socialism. It has its origins in capitalism. And so for him to stand there and sort of encourage wealth destroying policies and ideas is just quite incredible. But it is, I think, not unusual in the sense that I think the ANC doesn't always preach socialism. It forgets to do so sometimes, and then sometimes it remembers and it says, oh, yes, that's right, we're socialist, we must go back to those ideas. And the problem is, of course, that whenever they're faced with challenges or problems like unemployment, the default response is to go back to socialism, to socialist ideas. And that is where we see the policy thrust coming from that we are observing in the public sphere, as we have been doing for many years. It seems to be gaining steam now, which is to centralize power even further in the hands of the state, to promote state intervention in the economy, to develop master plans, to coordinate the economy, discourage imports and promote exports. So it is quite a statist policy, and I do think that the guiding philosophy quite undoubtedly is socialist in origin, and it is sometimes refreshing to see it so explicitly stated as it was over the weekend by Mr. Ramaphosa.
So, Sarah, I think one of the more outrageous things that he said in this was he implied that the reason that we had the COVID-19 pandemic was capitalism. In the quote here on the SABC from his address, he said, "The social, political, and economic conditions that make this pandemic possible are precisely the conditions that the South African Communist Party has dedicated its existence to overcoming." What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's quite funny. Yes, it's probably very much a result of a leak from a lab at capitalist autocratic People's Republic of China, for which he had very, very warm words earlier this week. So the man is nothing if not a complete hypocrite. But the social, I mean, I've pointed out over a number of years that he is a socialist, that his wealth was garnered by acting on behalf of the ANC. It was about essentially taking the capitalist sector for a ride, which made him very wealthy, which certainly for a time made the ANC wealthy. But, you know, it's funny. It's absolutely the sort of speech one would expect someone to make to the Communist Party on its 100th birthday. It has amazing longevity, this Communist Party. But, I mean, the speech could have been written, barring a few facts, could have been written in 1952. I'm still waiting for the myriad of examples of capitalist exploitation that are destroying this country left, right, and center. So it's such a cliche. It would be funny if it weren't so serious. It also brings to mind, why does the SACP have to do much? Because the ANC is doing it anyway, and they are completely intertwined and interlinked. It's really classical socialist sort of bravado that goes with the occasion. I have some doubt about the actual existence of two factions in the ANC, other than there's the pro-Zuma faction and there's maybe the pro-Ramaphosa faction, because when it comes to rapid economic transformation, which is supposed to be related to the pro-Zuma faction, we are rapidly economically transforming through all these socialist policies that are just hitting the deck very, very quickly, and nothing has happened more quickly than since Ramaphosa himself came to power. And he's avowed that he's a socialist, so it was the right occasion to say what he actually really feels.
Indeed. And I just wish that foreign commentators and elite commentators would take these pronouncements, take what the ANC says about itself a little bit more seriously than just sort of assuming that it's lying about itself. John, any final thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, I think what is also worth pointing out is how conspicuous by their absence are any comments by Mr. Ramaphosa in support of capitalism. Mm. So when our detractors say that this is all just rhetoric and it's actually not really guiding principle, well, if that's the case, then where are the strong statements to business societies saying capitalism, free markets are really what we need in order to lift people out of poverty? And we're not hearing very much on that. And I think that is quite telling.
Sorry, can I just add there that in sort of looking for statements, somehow when it comes to working with businessmen and calling for investment, there's never, as John says, there's never that endorsement of capitalism as the means to get people out of poverty. Never seen it. But if you look carefully, there are speeches where he said very clearly that he is a socialist. And I think, take the man at his word.
Indeed. So let us move on to our final story for today, and that is the National Youth Development Agency. So I will not begrudge any of our listeners or watchers if they don't know what this organization is, but it is a government organization which is supposed to, well, develop the youth with skills and training and all that sort of thing. But it doesn't really seem to make the news much, except when it has arguments over who is in charge. So, of course, this has been the most recent thing. Parliament has recommended more names to be considered for the National Youth Development Agency board. And the main thrust here was that the board, it needs to be more diverse and inclusive. In this case, specifically on the axis of gender, the chairperson of the National Youth Development Agency saying, this time it must be dominated by females, unlike in previous years whereby it was dominated by males. But remember, our wish is that the National Youth Development Agency is chaired by a female. Sara, what is the point of the National Youth Development Agency? I mean, allegedly it's about skills development, but that doesn't really seem to be very, it doesn't seem to be very good at it.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, it's either fights over who's in charge or fights over who's lost the money or where the money's gone or which money's been overspent. I take the view that there's absolutely no need for a National Youth Development Agency. You know, you often get this thing of we must pay more attention to the youth. They have fresh ideas. Fresh ideas by all means, but I don't think the youth as a sort of collective has any more ideas about creating jobs as the rest of us. And we know that jobs, you don't create jobs and you don't train people in a vacuum. You give people this place to create businesses. Businesses need employees. Employees or people are then employed. That's kind of how it goes. And that's what we keep begging the government for. But it comes up with things like the National Youth Development. I don't see why they should be particularly alert to what youth need to be developed for. It's something that the demand should actually be driven by the business sector. So, I once went there and I met a couple of very hardworking women, as it so happened, but I doubt there were many on the board. But my impression is that the board is largely a space for sort of testosterone-driven young men. So good luck to the women and the disabled who want to get onto the board. I don't think they'll be put there on sort of BEE terms. But the money could be far better spent in really targeting business, encouraging business creation and thereby sort of sponsoring the need for specific skills. Because you can in just having skills doesn't help a great deal in the current climate.
They're also quite ambitious. I see their most recent program is the National Project to Build Youth Resilience, where they want to build up the mental well-being and resilience of the youth. John, are we being too harsh on the Youth Development Agency?
I think absolutely not. so the story, you know, is just such a good sign of a completely misplaced focus, you know, where you say the organization exists to achieve a goal and it should be measured on its ability to achieve that goal alone and not on, you know, its internal configuration. Who cares about that? You know, this is a sign of an organization that's inwardly focused, that's dealing with itself, it's dealing with its positions and a distribution of funds and money and so on, but has, I think, very little impact outside in the real world where the impact is needed. And as Sara was saying, you know, if this organization wanted to really make a difference, it should completely ignore the demographics of its management. This organization should be going out and saying, you know, scrap BE, scrap the race laws, scrap the assault on property rights, get the economy growing, and then young people will get jobs. You know, that will be a logical outcome of that. That's the way to do it. And not sort of funding useless initiatives. It's a pure waste of taxpayer money. And I think it really is a boondoggle for the people who work there. It's an organization that I think could be closed down with very little negative impact and possibly a positive impact if those funds were better deployed. So, yeah, that's my two cents on that.
Indeed. To me, it seems to mostly be a way of giving out patronage, basically. It's a patronage channeling network for the ruling party. And it could be much better spent, that money. Anyway, enough bashing the NYDA. Let us call it to a close for today and indeed for the week. We hope that you enjoyed the show. Please support the Institute of Race Relations, which of course funds the Daily Friend, by becoming a friend of the Institute. SMS your name to 32823 and sign up to become a friend, which means giving a small monthly donation, less than 100 rand, basically. Anyway, thanks very much. We hope you have a wonderful weekend, and we will see you next week for the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.